You are listening to Indie Creators in the Joy Zone with your host, Thomas Artavani and Suzanne Toro. We are streaming worldwide on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google Play, and Amazon Music. Let's jump into the Joy Zone.
Where the wind blows, when this day is done, breathe, breathe in the air, set your intentions, dream with care. Tomorrow's a new day for everyone. Brand new moon and brand new sun. Well, welcome to Indie Creators. Colin Hooten is beaming in from Living Tea, located in Telluride, Colorado. Colin, really excited to have you here today. And I don't know if you can see it yet, but I happen to, on the table, have the winter teas that were sent out. So we'll dive into those a little bit later.
Oh, wait a second. I think I actually have those. Actually, I think I have a shot of those winter teas.
So what have you been up to? How is Telluride right now? Is it full of snow?
It's been a dry winter, you know. It's been kind of a strange year. Between there not being much snow and everybody locked in their houses, I think we're all about to lose our minds around here.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking of you the other day when I was looking at the mountain structure in Telluride, that you must really go way out oftentimes, Colin. How has the alchemy of the earth been treating you out there?
Well, you know, the reason I like living here is because we're on the edge of civilization. Meaning that you can go in three directions from my house, and once you get about 10 minutes away, you're on the edge of town, and from there you could go into the mountains without seeing anybody for many, many days, I think.
Nice.
If that's what somebody's looking for, then it's wonderful. I mean, you know, there's a real sense of living in the wild here. So.
Right. I could tell from all the pictures of your hiking. You resonate really well with the earth there. You're not looking to up and move out of there anytime soon.
I think if I can pull it off, I'll just stay here until I die.
Nice. And so share a little bit with the listeners about the center. I know that it was all opening right about when COVID came down the pike for the world. How has that been? How have you transitioned into that space, in and out of that space, because we've kind of been on a ping pong match a little bit with this experience?
Yeah, well, so as you know, I started traveling extensively about 12 years ago throughout Asia, both to study Chinese medicine more thoroughly or more deeply, but also in search of old growth trees, and to learn more from the traditions that have developed what's called Chadao or Chanoyu in Japan, the way of tea, and in search of teachers, but also wanting to just go spend time in these, you know, forests of 1500-year-old tea trees. And fast forward 12 years, and we found ourselves up here in the mountains, and my partner and I decided to open a traditional tea house and art gallery. I kind of think of it more as like a zendo or a shala or you know, a dojo of sorts.
Yeah.
But it could be approached by the average person walking down the street is just a beautiful art gallery that has really extraordinary tea and that likes to brew it in a way that is inconvenient if you're accustomed to tea bags and a mug. But it was a place for teaching a lot of Taoist and Buddhist ideas, and also to house this tradition of Chinese medicine, Taoist medicine, clinical herbalism, acupuncture, but also a formal tea house. So I kind of say, you know, we had a lot of teachings sort of hidden in plain sight, and you could meet the space wherever you were at. And so we spent about 10 months renovating it. It was an old bike shop for 24 years, so it was really beat up and run down. And, you know, there was dirt floors in the back, and we rebuilt it from the ground up. You know, we had to rebuild the attic because it's a 130-year-old, you know, an old mining building, or a building from the old mining days. And we redid the floors and the walls and the windows and the ceiling, and turned it into a formal fine art gallery and tea house. So we got our final inspection on March 8th. Yay. On March 15th, we were supposed to open, and on March 13th, everything shut down. Yeah. So we are not formally open yet, and it's been a wild ride, but we're not alone, right? So,
no, but you're still there.
We're still here, and luckily we've got a pretty loyal following online. So, you know, we've been able to take a step back and revisit a lot of the infrastructure and the systems and the processes behind everything that we do. And so we've been able to kind of ride this wave. But because all of our operating expenses really ramped up in March, we didn't qualify for any of the loans or grants or anything. So, you know, I kept talking to friends, and they go, well, you know, it's been kind of nice in a way. Like, I've been out of work for 3 months, but it's sort of been like an extended vacation. I've been, you know, biking and hiking and skiing. And I go, well, we've just been working our brains out trying to figure out how to,
to keep things going.
Yeah, to keep things going, because we weren't able to open. So,
right. Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like you, whereas, and I kind of concur. It's like, run, Forrest, run, keep going. So I guess it just depends how we met it. Now, share with the listeners a little bit about what you have available online, being that the world appears, at least here in California, we radically opened really rapidly last week, that we'll be opening. So maybe you'll have some tourists, but everyone can dive into your tea online. So if you'll share right now what your offerings are, and you have some great immune support, Chinese herbalism and teas available too, which I think everyone's maybe more aware of how important it is to preload your system versus try to catch up if you get ill.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have a background, as you know, in traditional Chinese medicine. And so a lot of the basis of what we carry obviously is tea oriented, but also we carry a lot of medicinal herbal formulas and single herbs and tinctures, some of which are strongly antiviral, some are immunostimulants, some are angiolytics to help with anxiety, sleep, you know, overwhelm. Obviously, this is a time, you know, everybody talks about the three crises, right? So the health crisis and the economic crisis, and then the mental health crisis, because this is obviously an incredibly intense and overwhelming period for a lot of people. And so it kind of depends on what folks are looking for. You know, there was a big study done, and you can read about this on the website, but yes, indeed, that's what it is. There was a big study done subsequent to SARS-1 in the early 2000s in China, and they looked at 720 natural compounds to try to determine, are there any that are particularly effective in inhibiting viral replication with SARS-1? And because SARS-2 or COVID-19 is the nucleotide sequence is between 96 and 97% identical to SARS-1. Of course, when I said this to my brother, who's a doctor, he said, well, those 3 to 4% make a big difference. For example, apes and humans. And I said, well, yeah, I understand. But the point here is that when you have such a similar nucleotide sequence, oftentimes viral replication is similar. So substances that have inhibitory action are going to work similarly. So out of these 720 substances, what they found was the most effective were red tea and puer tea, which I thought was just amazing. Because I think there's a lot of things that are magical about tea, but in this case, it seems to speak directly to some of the issues we're looking at collectively. So I tell people drinking red tea or puer tea is not going to prevent you from contracting COVID. However, we can stack the cards in our favor by supporting our immune system, making sure our bio train is balanced and that we're as healthy as humanly possible, and certainly drinking tea as opposed to, say, alcohol or any of the other substances that are used to address stress or overwhelm or kind of mental emotional issues, tea is definitely going to support that a lot more than most other substances out there. So
definitely, you know, a hug for sure, since we can't hug each other.
It's like a tree hugging you from the inside.
Yeah.
The other thing that we have been carrying that is part of kind of a lot of the immunity offerings is this formula called the Jade Windscreen 21-day formula, which I've just run out of because the herbs in it are in such high demand internationally that we seem to be going through it really quickly. But it's based on the work of a guy named John Chen, who's a Chinese doctor and also a PhD. He's not a chemist, but he studies the chemical constituents of herbs, of Chinese herbs. So he's interested in understanding their traditional application, but also the way that we can understand them through biomedical science.
Right.
And he looked at, you know, China is no stranger to epidemics throughout history, and Chinese medicine's been around for a very long time. And he looked at similar epidemics and then what kind of formulas were being used, and then developed a formula of antiviral and immunostimulant herbs that dry up the lung phlegm and they support digestion and they treat all the early stage symptoms of COVID, like headache and fever and muscle pain. And between those and the strong antiviral herbs, it's really a potent preventative medicinal formula. And so we started carrying that formula with links to all of Dr. Chen's videos, because he really goes into extraordinary depth into the Western understanding of COVID, but also how we're treating it through integrated medicine. And I've been taking this brew every day and I feel pretty darn good, and our whole staff is. And they've done these big epidemiological studies of healthcare workers in big hospitals in China. And the healthcare workers consistently taking this formula, they found like a 94% reduction in the percentages of them contracting COVID. So it's a big moment, I think, for Chinese medicine in the world. You know, but it's weird. You know, we try to put up ads through like Google or Instagram or Facebook promoting some of our antivirals, and
they put a sticker on you and say no.
Yeah, they go, nope, these guys are trying to actually help people.
Well, that's been the interesting. I think it's actually been a good thing, because you know, it's kind of like the teenage kid where your parents say you can't do that, so then you really find a way to do that. So
right.
I think most people, when they keep seeing that, and I think, you know, society at large had already been participating in natural well-being versus maybe exclusively just big pharma. So that's, I think, it will turn around in the near future. So you've also had a beautiful addition to your family, a son. How has that impacted you? How does that bring you joy, Colin? I want to see you. I cannot wait to visit you and see you as a dad.
I know. It'd be better if we were talking in person. You know, soon enough, I hope.
Yeah.
Well, his name's Lyndon, and he's 7 months old, and he's a little shining like beaming bundle of joy and happiness. I don't, you know, they say, people say like, I heard somebody say, well, you know, it's kid karma. So I'm sure you were sweet until you were like 14, just, you know, given 14 years.
Well, and we know how you were as a teenager. So
yeah. So I, you know, we'll see what happens, but at the moment, we're just thrilled, Jade and I, and we're, you know, I think I got really lucky in the sense that he just seems to be such a happy and wonderfully joyful little human. So
that's a good sign. How have you been filling up as far as like tea ceremony, and how are you finding ways to engage with the world at large?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing some podcasts. I've been doing a lot of writing. So actually, I think you might enjoy, I just wrote a lengthy article called Nourishing Life about the history of food from going all the way back pre-agricultural revolution up through the Industrial Revolution, Scientific Revolution, and where we're at now. And then it talks a lot about the perspective from Taoist medicine on food as medicine. Mm. And, you know, it gets into how kind of the uniform, precise schedule of industry since the Industrial Revolution has changed humans in ways that we don't always recognize or appreciate, and how important it is to acknowledge some of our older ways of doing things and some of the ancestral wisdom that we've lost largely.
That's the book you wrote?
It's a lengthy article I just recently wrote called Nourishing Life. It's on the website on our blog.
Come on now, do tell. Come on, you did all that research. What's the essence? Come on, give us a little bit.
Well, the essence,
What have we got to do as humans to figure this thing out? What was the main ancestral pull there?
Well, one thing I will say, and this is even going pre-agricultural revolution, is that we had this dazzling variety and array of food that we ate when we were living more as hunter-gatherers or semi-agricultural, semi-nomadic. In the average day, the amount of food that was consumed, you know, tubers and roots and berries and seeds and animals and leaves, was just extraordinarily vast. And so on one hand, you know, you hear a lot of people nowadays talking about the gut microbiome and the importance of homeostasis or allostasis in the microorganisms that inhabit the stomach lining in the gut.
You are listening to Indie Creators in the Joy Zone with your host, Thomas Artavani and Suzanne Toro. We are streaming worldwide on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google Play, and Amazon Music. Let's jump into the Joy Zone.
Commonly known to the layman as probiotic?
Probiotics, yes, exactly. Right. Probiotics and prebiotics.
No one has the best syntax ever.
But
right over my head.
Not by design, I apologize.
No, so, I'll check you because okay, you just cool. Figure I'm the lowest common denominator, so if I get it, then everybody will get it.
Okay, great. And as we know now, and we're learning more and more with understanding the gut biome, the intrinsic immune system, you could say our fundamental foundational immune system, is dependent upon and fueled by and informed by all those microorganisms in the colonies of bacteria in the gut. And what feeds them to make them really resilient communities of bacteria is a wide variety of food. One reason why I think we're starting to see so many you know, adult onset allergies and chronic degenerative diseases and preventable diseases is because our food system has been so whacked out, which, you know, this could be a whole series of podcasts. One thing to take away is that humans have hybridized food over and over and over again. So like the example I like to use is in the 1600s, I think it was the Dutch, there was the House of Orange, and a war was won, and the scientists of the time, to celebrate the winning of that war, took an Afghani purple carrot, the original carrot, and a mutated white carrot, and they figured out how to hybridize them into an orange carrot, and they presented it to the House of Orange and said, congratulations on this big victory. And the orange carrot became in vogue throughout Europe, and now what do we generally eat a lot of? Orange carrots. Now that's fine, you know, who cares about the color of a carrot, except that the nutrient density of an orange carrot versus a purple Afghani or even the white carrot is like 300 times less phytonutrient density. And so if you extrapolate that out over all these other foods, like the sweet yellow onion, onions were never sweet like that. You know, that was the East Coast in the early 1900s. Or apples, how many different varieties of apples do we have now? And on and on and on. And you see this across all these different food groups. And then you combine that with the way that the soil, through pesticides, herbicides, larvicides, weed killers, fertilizers, has been compromised. And then glyphosate, you know, Dr. Zach Bush's work has become more well-known recently. But glyphosate breaking down the tight cell junction in the intestines, but also all the mucous membranes throughout the body. And we're not absorbing nutrients properly. And in addition, the nutrients aren't there because of how we mess with the food and the soil. So one takeaway is eat a large variety of food. And one way to take the guesswork out of that is by joining a local CSA, because then you're naturally going to get what foods are in season. And it forces you to figure out, what the hell do I do with a kohlrabi or, you know, eggplant or whatever.
I just want to know what the hell a CSA is.
It's called Community Supported Agriculture. So it's like, you know, most places, definitely in California.
Like those food
boxes. Yeah, they send you a food box. It's usually not more expensive than going to the grocery store. And you get a lot of organic, seasonally grown food that was picked in the last couple of days instead of picked, you know, 3 weeks ago in Mexico and put on the shelf, has things added to it so that it'll stay, quote, fresh longer. So, you know, getting to know local farmers also is a way for us to connect with the earth and the seasons in ways that we don't tend to do very much nowadays. So,
absolutely.
Well, you seem to have a unique perspective, and certainly you're living the life. I mean, Telluride's pretty beautiful. And
yeah, it's all right. Well, I can't complain, you know. It's so expensive that you're broke no matter.
You guys still have it's like 80% men and guys walking around with pistols on their hips. Everybody's still carrying up there.
I would say that I'm glad that I'm not a single man here, because yes, there are certainly a lot more men than there are women. And you know, it's an interesting place because on one hand, you either have people who are hardcore, like extreme sport enthusiasts, you know, like jumping off cliffs with parachutes and skiing and out in backcountry and like extreme sports, or you've got kind of the residual sort of hippie population from the 70s who came up here because it was really progressive and laid back in the 70s. And there's a lot of great music, live music all year round.
You go to that jazz festival every year for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we get some really incredible artists up here.
Right? Yeah, that film festival is still extraordinary. I guess they, you know, see what they do this year with it. But and of course, the skiing and the scenery and that old mining history, the gold mining history that you have up in the hill there above you is pretty wild to go up there and see that the community lived up there and existed at such an altitude.
Yeah, I mean, there's a town up there called Tomboy, which had at one point 8,000 to 9,000 people. And like you said, now it's a ghost town way up in the mountains. But when you go up there, you go, I can't believe people lived here. I mean, it's just mind-blowing, you know?
Wow, like a little Himalayan chateau.
Oh no! So like the little road that they pull you up there, you go up there, and like you realize that there's like donkeys pulling carts and people and everything up there, and then you got like it's not like a 2-lane highway, it's just like a 1-lane road. It's like
yeah, tiny little road.
To the one side of you, you fall to your death. It's crazy.
I was just gonna say, there's kind of an interesting demographics because you got the extreme sports, you got the music lovers, the more progressive folks, then you got the leftover miners from the old mining families, and those are the ones you're going to see walking down the street with a gun hanging off their hip, you know.
Yeah,
then you've got the wealthy billionaires like Oprah and Tom Cruise with their massive chateaus, and then you've got kind of the rest of us. So
you definitely got to do that altitude training thing before you get up there, otherwise you're just going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, well, we're up at 9,000 feet, so it's no joke, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely no joke. So you live a wonderful, you must have an interesting perspective on what's going on. And then I would imagine as you head into the inner cities and you take a look around, and or you just look at the news and you look at California and it's a couple hundred thousand plus homeless, and looking at a society that's stressed and needing some form of relief and assurance, it seems like your tea and your perspective on longevity and health is really super relevant these days. I mean, how are you actively communicating or getting this out to these really in need communities?
You know, when we weren't able to open the tea house, we did some things for our local community here in terms of just acupuncture, herbalism, tea, etc. But also we started doing a lot of marketing and advertising just so people out there in the social media world can find us. Because, you know, the teas we're carrying are really unique in that most people think of tea and they think of a tea bag that they put in a mug. They don't think of it as medicinal, as a medicinal herb. But what's different is the teas we're carrying, a lot of them are from 800 to 1,000-year-old tea trees. Trees that are grown from seed, free of any kind of agrochemicals, and then they're processed in a particular way. So
you just said something kind of weird. You said a 1,500-year-old tree.
The oldest tea tree we have on record is over 3,200 years old.
Oh my God.
The oldest one I've
500-year-old tea.
What's yeah, the oldest tree I've the oldest tree I've seen with my own eyes. Was a 2,200-year-old tea tree, which was huge, and they don't harvest it anymore, but they harvest all the smaller trees around it. And, you know, tea is a totally different plant at that point, you know, both from just a medicinal qualities and, you know, polyphenols and antioxidants and all that, but also the way it makes you feel. It's not really comparable to what you buy in Whole Foods in a tea bag or whatever.
Well, and share a little bit about the spiritual essence of the tea that comes through.
Historically, the earliest mention of tea is from some herbal pharmacopoeias that go back to 2000 BC in China. That's the first mention we have of tea being used as a medicinal herb. And it's in a category called the Shen tonic. So without going off on Chinese medicine right now, I'll give you a brief explanation, which is the earliest descriptions say that tea brightens the eyes. And one way to interpret that is that it nourishes the liver blood, which then makes your eyes clear. Or you could say because of the caffeine, it's a slight stimulant, so it makes you more aware, so the eyes are clear. But that's actually a misunderstanding of what's meant by that. What it really means is that tea has this remarkable capacity, it's an adaptogenic herb, to both calm the spirit or to calm the mind so that the mind slows down, which is the source of all our anxiety. In the words of Osho, no mind, no problem, right?
Yeah.
So tea calms the mind, but it also opens the heart, and then it moves stagnant energy through the body. So patterns of energy, psychosomatic energy that's held, what we call samskaras in Sanskrit or gratis, knots of energy, that come from trauma or fear or difficulties, psycho-emotional issues. Those knots are bound energy. So tea breaks those up, but then it leaves you with a calm mind and the heart open so that you can actually process the clearing of those energies. So if one drinks tea and treats it as a practice, you know, a mindfulness practice, I always say put a couple leaves in a bowl and drink three bowls of tea in silence in the morning with no phone or emails or any technology. You know, the hardest thing I think for a human being to do is to do nothing. So try to sit and do nothing for 15 minutes and have three cups of tea in silence and see what emerges, what comes to the surface. You know,
you are doing something. You're sitting there drinking tea.
This is true. So actually here's a different way of putting it. Try to actually do it with attention. So instead of a tea bag and a mug while you're on the phone and you're also, you know, trying to get a leash on your dog and doing 20 other things, just create a 15-minute ritual a day where you're just doing one thing. That's it. You know, one definition of Zen Buddhism is doing one thing at a time. Not just doing one thing physically at a time, but also doing only one thing with the mind at the same time. So,
You know, it'll be interesting to hear your definition of health. I mean, what is your, how do you define optimal health, and how are you probably maintaining yourself? But what advice would you have for just the regular person out there that's eating that Western diet, poisoning themselves every day, unintentionally, of course. But we're seeing a lot of, you know, there's a lot of chronic illness out there. And I guess through your eyes, because you've taken it to such a refined art, you know, through understanding outside entities to help restore something on the inside, and then taking this then perspective and then combining the practice with, you know, putting good stuff in your body. How do you define
health? Well, I think health, and this is a definition that I'm borrowing and then adding my own twist on it from one of my teachers, who Suzanne knows, Wuda in Taiwan. Yeah. He likes to define health as anything, and he does mean anything, that puts you in harmony with all life on earth. And that might be a little esoteric or abstract if somebody's like, well, how the hell does that help me decide what to eat for breakfast? And my response is, well, what you're choosing to eat for breakfast, did it come from a place of harmony and wellness to begin with? So one way of thinking about that is, like, you know, there's a saying, there are rules around, you wouldn't even call it prayer. You'd call it intentionality in Zen Buddhism with, before you eat a meal, you know? And the first of them is we reflect on the effort and sacrifice that went into this food. And that's a very non-abstract thing to reflect on. There were farmers that grew that food, and then there were truck drivers that drove it somewhere. And then there are people who put it on the shelves at a grocery store or grew it at a local farm. And then there was the preparation of the food itself. And then there's the money that you worked hard to make to buy the food. So there's a lot of effort and sacrifice that went into it all the way along. And human beings, we tend to think that our food comes from a sterile shelf, you know, in a neon lit grocery store, because we're not in touch with the growing of food, you know.
Package.
It feels like you're a little outside that box, though. If you talk about health, and Wuda said anything that allows us to find harmony, is that what you said? Anything that allows us to find balance? Is that how did you put Wuda?
Anything that allows us to find harmony with all life on earth.
With all life on earth. So he basically, it's sort of a description of a condition, a state, a way to see things. It seems like, especially through a Zen practice, the practice is to find your way back to the present in order to align yourself with the truth of what's happening around you, sensorially speaking at least, and to return perspective to the moment at hand. And it feels like through the meditative repose and the teas and through proper diet, you're giving yourself, your mind, a better opportunity to possibly carve out a space for yourself to remember who you are in relation to time and space. These old trees that you're pulling the tea from, it's like How can you describe the difference between that 2,200-year-old tea tree and something we pull off the shelf here at Costco? And you know what? I got like 300 tea bags for $5.99 at like that grocery outlet.
Well, I mean, what I would say is try drinking a living tea and then, brew a green tea that's a living tea and then brew a green tea that's out of a tea bag and pay attention to how you feel. That's the easiest way to tell the difference. Yeah.
That's an interesting thing because that in itself, to be able to pay attention to that nuance of actually being present enough to feel a shift from tea, other than if unless it's, of course, loaded with caffeine, which is why I drink it. But it requires and of course we all know about this the tea ceremony. At least I've heard it through lore. Is there something to the tea ceremony? As you break bread with these 2,200-year-old tea trees?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the way that what you bring to it is intentionality in a tea ceremony. And I suppose you could bring great reverence and intentionality to taking a tea bag out of a box and preparing tea in a mug. A lot of it's a state of mind. I remember Suzanne once talking about one of her friends who she said, he was so clear in his intentionality that he could go eat Kentucky Fried Chicken and not only feel not conflicted about it, but he still maintained a equanimity and clarity of thought and of the way he lived. And I think, there are a lot of things that transcend a purely material level of existence. So the mind you bring to it, the intention you bring to anything, of course, you want that in scientific terms. It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, right? That the consciousness of the observer changes the outcome of the observed, which, that's quantum physics is starting to say a whole lot about that, which is they were talking about this stuff back in the Upanishads or the Rig Vedas, the earliest texts in the planet. They already had this one figured out, which is everything's connected and everything you do is connected to everything else. So,
right.
But at least science is catching up. It just took us a couple thousand years. Sure, you could bring great intentionality and reverence to the fact that tea is a very labor-intensive process. So even just a sense of respect for the fact that the tea farmers had to work really, really hard to get that tea to you is one level. The tea ceremony at the furthest extreme, there's a lot of study and intentionality that goes into a tea ceremony. So a tea ceremony is a vehicle for teaching the non-verbal, non-dogmatic teachings of nature, from nature. It's even more direct to the source than, say, Taoist or Buddhist thought or shamanic practices, shamanic thought. Going beyond the words to describe those teachings, we have a saying in our tradition, which is the sutras are written in the veins of the leaf. Which I like a lot, it's almost like it's a language that's precognitive. And in that way, it's more direct. It speaks more directly to the heart. It speaks more to our being as a whole, as opposed to speaking only to our intellect.
You are listening to Indie Creators in the Joy Zone with your host, Thomas Artavani and Suzanne Toro. We are streaming worldwide on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google Play, and Amazon Music. Let's jump into the Joy Zone.
It moves.
Well, that's a lot of intellect you got going on there. Talking about intentionality and veins through leaves without any explanation whatsoever. Come on now. Analogy. Veins through leaves. Come on now.
So veins through the sutras.
The sutra is an interpretive lesson, right?
Is going to go where it needs to go. What I've found to share with the listeners, and I'm very thankful for Colin finding Wuda in Taiwan, is that the tea will go where it needs to go. And even, if I have people on retreat and I'm serving them tea ceremony during the process, it definitely goes where they go. And you can have a group of people and they're all having a different experience why they drink the tea, which is really powerful and speaks to the fact that sutra is so unique to the person, what they're ready to receive and what the alchemy of the tree world is ready to offer and assist with. I think it's one of the most simplest and beautiful way that we can nourish ourselves and others.
Yeah, and to connect on a deeper level with ourselves and with other people. Yeah. You know, I say it's like a positive Trojan horse, Tia's.
Yeah.
Or because it's the second most consumed beverage on the earth. Or if you include the fact that it's 70% water, it's the most consumed beverage on the earth.
Yeah.
Nobody finds tea offensive. Nobody goes, oh, nope. Those tea drinkers, you know, it's really a non-offensive and very accessible thing.
So right now in your life, if you didn't have tea, where would you be? Would you be in like the gutter somewhere? Or?
I'd probably just be working on Wall Street. I'd probably be managing a hedge fund in San Francisco, you know?
Oh, no, not now.
I think you'd be doing your 100% of the time or something like that.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, no,
that's an interesting assessment because you can see that the how he approaches your tea. I mean, I'm not talking about you like you're not here. There you are, right there.
Oh, hi, hello.
But you're correlating the effort to move into a quality existence when you return to your tea, it sounds like. So it's kind of like a little alarm clock throughout the day to return to the moment at hand and to remind yourself that you're just here in harmony with time and space, and to keep that programmed and, or at least close to the front of your mind so that the world doesn't take you too far away. Like right now, if you were to be better, if you wanted to be better, like what tea would you drink right now?
Well, I think if you think that drinking tea is going to somehow enhance you, then you got to total it. You don't understand tea. I mean, there's a saying by this guy, Rikyu, who was a Zen tea master alive 1600s, where he said, if your life would be any different without tea, then you're yet to understand tea. Which is a very Zen thing to say.
Yeah.
You know,
you just said yourself, without the tea, you'd be on Wall Street dealing with some hedge.
Yeah, but.
Oh, this is cheeky something. Sounds very funny.
Come on, man.
I'm just being a smartass. So.
Yeah. I know, but honestly, I mean, it's like, yeah, if somebody thinks that tea is going to make you better, but here it is.
Here's what I can say.
So, like, without my practice, like, if you didn't have your Zen practice, If you feel, and you've seen people without Zen practice, you can see where your destiny lay without your practice. That's absolute hell on earth, right? It's just a karmic spinning circle of repeated concepts and imitated educational perspectives, and we're just basically spinning around the same little planet, putting up walls, and as our universe gets smaller and smaller. So there we are without the practice, right?
I think, you know, it's funny that I'm going to start this sentence with I think, but I think when I observe most humans, the general state that humans are living in is lost in thought, you know, myself included. And if there's not any effort or practice to step out of this discursive lost in thought, living in the future or the past, being pulled by my impulses in one direction or another, if there's not any effort made to connect to something deeper beneath the noise of the thinking process or the thinking center, then our life, we'll get to the end of it and just go, what did I do? Well, I don't know. I just was lost in thought the whole time. There's not a connection to really the moment. You know, and my young boy has been the greatest teacher. I have practices and alarm clocks I set throughout the day to try to, you know, live a little more mindfully, a little more awake. Tea is certainly one of them. But my little guy's been the greatest teacher because anytime you're like doing anything else, he's like, what's the deal? Like, we could be having so much more fun if you weren't thinking about something else, you know? So he's a great teacher in that way. But there's a wonderful saying, which is, a man of the world or man or woman of the world puts something on every day, whereas a man of the Tao takes something off. Mm. And so a lot of the work I'm trying to do is to take off all the things that aren't essential, that aren't necessary or real, to try to minimize the amount of extraneous thinking and doing, so that the thinking and doing I do is actually grounded and real and intentional. Mm-hmm. So I think tea can help us a lot in learning about intentionality.
You've used that word like 27 times, intentionality. So it's like that's an important word. And can you define that for us in terms of putting it into practice? What is that?
Care. It means, really taking the time to care about what we're doing, to recognize the value of what we're doing, and to take the time to get in touch with why we're doing what we're doing. Mm. You know, I saw a lot of patients for Chinese medicine, for acupuncture and body work and diet and herbs and things over a number of years. I'm not now with COVID and this tea house project, but when I would ask them difficult questions like, why are you here? And they go, oh, well, because my shoulder, you know. I go, no. Why are you here? Why are you alive? What's your purpose? Who are you? Not who do you think you are? Like, who are you really, you know? And I get in there and I'd ask these questions, and people would, sometimes they'd appreciate it because nobody'd ask them those questions. And other times they go, give me an effing break. I just came here because I got a frozen shoulder, you know? Like, get out of my business, basically, right?
Go ahead and break them down and say, you know what? What's obstructing you within your deepest of mindsets is also the same entity that's taken root in your shoulder. So if we want to really deal with your shoulder, we want to get into possibly what's going on inside your head so we can do both things at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly perfectly right. And if you do it well, if you got the right bedside manner, then sometimes people are actually open to it.
So why do you do what you do? What's the purpose of your life?
I did just want to finish that thought, which is that I just realized in that process that most folks couldn't really answer those questions, that a lot of folks have a fairly superficial relationship to their lives and to why they're here. And as a result, it's hard to have clear intentionality. If you don't really know what the hell you're doing in general, then how can you bring great intentionality or any kind of vivifying force to what you're doing in a given day? And so that's just something that I've worked with folks a lot on. I think at the deepest level of healing, what we call the inner tradition of Chinese medicine or Taoist medicine is getting a person really connected to what we call the Ming. And the Ming is your contract with heaven. It's your reason. It's your raison d'etre. It's the reason that you are here in this incarnation with all your craziness and your wonderful constitutional makeup and your family and your whatever you got, that you were given for a particular reason in this lifetime. That's when a person gets that really dialed in, then their life takes on a different dimension of depth.
All right, what's your Ming, man? What's your Ming, man?
Well, I just described it. Yeah, I'm working with the plants to help people realign with their own purpose. Yeah.
And how does that help you? Clearly, there's a reciprocation. It's just not selfless.
How it helps me is I derive a lot of joy from it. I think I've kind of gotten to a place where what lights me up the most is when I see people kind of have breakthrough moments. So, or to be able to shift their life, you know, anybody who's tried to change in their lives realizes it's really hard, you know, it's extraordinarily challenging. Yeah. So
well, that's one of
if
the
I can...
from my understanding, that's one of the greatest gifts that you can give somebody is, and I guess that by definition is love, to be able to help somebody else balance or to reconnect with source is the greatest act of love one could possibly perform.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the more we can do that, the more, as individuals for other people, not only is this world a nicer place to live, but it also means that we're happier as individuals. So, you know, what have we realized through COVID? We've realized that we need each other and that we're profoundly social creatures, right?
So, yeah. Well, and I like how you, you know, created a synonym for intentionality as caring. And then Thomas touched on selflessness, like to be of service. So if we connect to our mean, typically that's something that can serve others in a deep way. Can you expand upon that? Because a lot of times people will approach intention from a grasping versus a giving.
I think that is why I use the word caring, which is to try to bring a dimension of greater awareness to what you're doing. And oftentimes that means slowing down. So there are kind of, you know, we live in the age of hacking everything. You can't really hack beingness. Either you're growing in beingness or you're not. But there are ways, I think, to hack, you know, fake it till you make it, right? So
beingness.
There are ways.
Use the word. You slipped a little word in there. That's really a huge word. You said beingness.
Yes.
Beingness. Can you define that for us laymen?
I would say being lost in thought is a form of beingness, but it's also lost in thought, meaning that you're either, there's a curious feature to thought. You know, I'd say to people, if you want to see just how crazy you are, start a meditation practice. You know, when we observe thinking or thought itself, it's almost always in the future or the past. It's rarely actually connected to what's happening in that moment and where you are in this moment.
Unless you're doing something and trying to figure it out, right? If you're actually involved in something, trying to figure it out, like how does my washing machine work or my dishwasher, or why is it broke or how do I fix this? Then your thinking is directed towards a specific activity to help solve a problem, right?
Yeah, and I would say that that activity could be done with greater or lesser beingness. Meaning, and that's where we get into a lot of the feminine based teachings historically, which are rooted in embodiment. So we see these in some of the Vajrayana Buddhist teachings and the tantric teachings and some of the earth based spiritual systems, which are, can you fix that dishwasher while still being aware of your feet on the ground? Or, you know, can you go in through a door and actually be aware of the feeling of the doorknob in your hand as you turn it and step through the doorway? This idea of being embodied, being more in your body, connected to your sensations. You know, the body has this wonderful quality in that it doesn't time travel. It's not in the future or the past. It's always here. And so the more that part of our consciousness is reserved for being connected to our physical being, the sensations in it, the emotions in it, whatever is happening, the greater the likelihood that you're actually more rooted in this moment. And, you know, one of the most basic principles of Zen is one can only live their lives here and now. You know, we are only existing in this moment. Your life is taking place right now. So I like saying to folks, this isn't a dress rehearsal, you know, there's not some time in the future when your life is going to begin. Like, this is it.
It's happening now.
It's happening right here and right now. So you might as well start living it. So,
was there a moment that can you reflect on in your life in terms of where it turned the corner? There's a moment where you woke up to this. Was there something happening contrary that forced you into, there wasn't an accident, or was there, you know, just a life thing that happened?
I mean, I would say in brief, there were two things. One was my grandfather was a very special man. He was interesting because he was a doctor and a Western scientist. He actually performed the second successful kidney transplant in Canada, which is kind of crazy, or in North America.
Wow, special, talented guy.
Yeah, he had 9 children, my mom being the oldest. And he was a devout Catholic, but he was also interested in Jung and all these yogis from India. And he, you know, lived in Africa for 10 years. And he was a very diverse interest and very open-minded. And he gave me the book Siddhartha when I was 13 by Hermann Hesse. And that kind of made me go...
For a 13-year-old.
Well, I remember reading and going... This doesn't seem to be what I'm being taught in school. I don't know what's going on here. But that definitely planted some early seeds of interest in Eastern ideas. And then I would say a second really significant thing was I went through a pretty profound depression when I was 16 around the recognition that nothing's permanent. Everything's impermanent. And I said, well, if everything's impermanent, then everything's devoid of emptiness and meaning. Mm. And the reason I got depressed subsequently was I made it very meaningful and significant that things are devoid of emptiness and meaning instead of recognizing.
Off the Richter scale.
I took that very seriously, you know. Instead of recognizing that it's empty and meaningless, that it's empty and meaningless, which is the basis of the Heart Sutra, which is an important text in Buddhist thought. And so I got really depressed, and then I kind of started observing how different parts of myself seemed to be in disagreement with each other. And I went, well, how is that possible? Why is it that in the morning I say I'm going to do one thing, and by the evening it's like a totally different person's there? Or, you know, I just got frustrated by what felt like was a faulty inner life, that things weren't working properly.
You didn't realize that you were a legion. You were many.
Yes, that I was a plural. I was a plurality. You know, there was too many different contradictory selves inside.
You're up on the Matrix, man. You were looking for Neo at an early age.
Yeah, I was like, I'm crazy, and I don't seem to know what to do about this. And then I started looking around and going, shit, so is everybody else. And I think I got pretty frustrated by it because I tried to talk to folks about this stuff when I was 16 or 17, and people kind of look at me out of one eye and go, what the hell is this guy on about? So that just started a pretty serious search, you know, over 20 years ago into who are we? Who am I? Why are we here? What's the deal with this whole situation?
Picking up where you left off.
Wow,
yeah, probably.
Feels like somewhere all suffering. Where's your suffering, damn it?
Yeah, I got plenty of that, but we all do, don't we?
That's true.
Well, now suffering is not even a... from that perspective, suffering is an opportunity and a welcome visitor because it allows you to challenge your own faith and your ability to perceive it and see it for what it is. If you're attached, you'll suffer, and if you're not, you won't, right?
Yeah. I remember I was sitting a 10-day meditation course in Thailand about 10 years ago, and there was this one monk that I really liked because he had such a lightheartedness about him. He was always laughing. I kind of went, I don't know, I'm pretty sure this guy's not faking it. Whatever he's doing, I think I need to do the same thing because he just had the joy of like a child, you know? And he gave a talk one day on the root of suffering, and he said, it's not about desire. Everybody, all the Westerners think, you know, Eastern traditions are so pessimistic because they say no desire, everything's suffering, you can't desire anything. He said, the issue is not desire. We're humans with senses and sensations. Of course we're going to desire things, you know. We desire food because we need it to survive. Like, of course you're going to desire. He said, the issue is not desire. The issue is craving. He said, the desire, if you can just be with it and say, oh, there's desire, is totally fine and healthy and normal. The issue is the craving and the attachment and the needing and the the clinging, the grasping. He said, that's where all the suffering starts coming in. And that was a helpful clarification for me because, you know, I was raised in a Christian world where we're just sinful. Everything of the body is sinful and it's all sinful. And, you know, we should start whipping ourselves. And, you know, it's that didn't work for me as a model. I said, this just doesn't seem quite right. So,
yeah, you want to know the virtue, well, celebrate the virtue.
Yeah, I guess what was it, one of those Zen koans? If you realize you're the problem, there is no problem.
right.
Something along those lines. Well, listen. Yeah. I mean, you've given us an hour. I mean, we've got a few minutes left.
You have to ask him the God question.
Oh, definitely. We wouldn't leave our
audience. Colin is God.
Yeah. So I mean, we like to, you know, because you're such a special guy. We know that you're going to have a wonderful gift for us at the end of this particular question. But if you were God, what would be the three things that you would do for your world? Three things.
Oh boy, I mean, that's a massive question just to drop on anybody, really. I mean,
now you know how your clients feel.
You got it.
Now you know your clients feel.
When you start asking,
why are you here?
Yeah, right. What's the point of your life? You know, I honestly don't know that I could even begin to answer that question.
Well, they go, just
what is what's the question? What the reason I can't answer is I don't know if I remember the question.
If you were God,
what, he is God. We're all God. We have divine.
You can start with one, but we're gonna pressure you for three. If you were God, what would be something that you would
bestow
upon this earth and upon its sentient beings? You know, if you had a wish, three wishes or three actions. Or three things that you could bestow upon us immediately, what would those three things be?
Like three magic wands.
And you can just start with one, and then we'll analyze one, and then we'll go to two, and then we'll go to three. So you don't have to.
Well, I think it's a tricky question because the first answer that comes to mind is having people recognize their own true realization of God in themselves. Because
nice, that's good. That's a good one.
At the deepest level of life, if we all were connected to that, the world would be just a fundamentally different place on every level.
So what was that one? What did he say?
Recognize God within themselves.
Oh, if you could recognize, if we could recognize you within everybody else. Got you. You want everybody to find you and everybody else. I got you. All right, that's one.
A true realization of God.
Because you're God now. So what you would like to see as God, you know, is certainly not an egocentric God. Why would he want to see himself and everybody else? But in this case, it works. In this case, God is an egoist in this particular perspective because he would want everybody to find that sense of freedom or wisdom or innate genius that they have within them. Got it. That's one. Good one.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with that comes omnipresence and eternal life and love and all the things, wisdom and clarity and all the things that could provide both meaning but also happiness for people in their lives. That would be numero uno.
That's a good one.
I guess number two would be for people to be connected to their own genuine wish to grow, that they would feel that as a driving light in their lives, because the wish to grow is something that can help carry us through most of our experiences, in the sense that if one's really connected to that wish, then even when they encounter extraordinary adversity and difficulty and suffering, which is inevitable in samsara, they could recognize in those experiences the profound opportunity there to consume those experiences as fuel for their growth.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think you wrap that up in a quest, right? You hope that people quest for their potential.
Yeah, I think, that they're connected to one of the reasons that I think we're all here, which is to grow, you know, to learn and to grow.
You know. So you want to see yourself and everybody.
Look, with my universal omnipotence, yes, I'm just trying to share some of the obvious for me.
Right. I don't know. That's not so obvious. I mean, nobody's ever said in like 3 years of doing shows and asking this question to quest, is how important it is to quest and to realize and seek one's potential in this time frame. So as to push the bar, basically, for the next time around, if there is a next time around. So
yeah, cool.
Good. And then the third one?
The third one, well, because you're talking about a quest, this is what comes to mind.
No, you're talking about a quest. That's your thing.
I'm talking about a quest.
Motivation to grow.
Which is, you know, when we get into like the hero's journey, you know, Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung and all that. The reluctant hero goes on a quest, you know, and they have to be reluctant because, because of humility. Because of humility. Because it's hard work. And they go on this extraordinary adventure that then changes them in the process. And in it, they discover some extraordinary gift. And then they bring the gift back to their community, and they bestow this blessing upon their community upon returning. And in returning, they've been changed by the experience. The giving of the gift at the end of the quest comes from this all-encompassing love. And so I don't know that everybody wants to go on some wild heroic adventure to the edges of the universe. Some people want to just be at home, you know?
Right.
But perhaps without having to go on the hero's journey, they can find this all-encompassing love within themselves and then live their lives from that place. So the third principle, the third thing as God, naturally, I would like people to be connected with is this all-encompassing, ever-present love that's available throughout our lives.
You know what? I think to sum up your third thing, if I may be so bold to talk to God in this particular respect, is that you what you really mean to say, God, is that you hope that after questing and realizing one's potential, that they return and to teach others and to be of service. It sounds like you use the word love in such a fashion in terms of to return. It felt like you were going, okay, well, God, is that like the most encompassing? You'd be a wonderful God, though. I mean, that's like,
he is a wonderful God.
I mean, how cool is that? I mean, that's like find God, you know, find me in all of you. Quest to realize your potential in the time frame you have, and once you figure that out, share it with others so they can live.
Exactly.
Them, bring them up, right?
Yeah, that's
so
it.
Beautiful. You
know,
that's crazy.
If you just don't want, if you want the easy that's route, wonderful. They can just feel that love and return it all to everyone.
Yeah, if they're not adventure seekers, if they're not extreme all season athletes like me, you know, then they can just sit at home and connect with it, through Instagram.
Well, let's throw this tea up here. And
Colin, it's such a treat to like sit and chat and receive some of your wisdom. Have you guys done any Zoom? I know this is so weird. I went to my first Zoom funeral, which was very strange. But I think, but I really would love to have a Zoom tea ceremony, I think.
Well, so we are going to start doing that soon. We're doing all sorts of things because we can't open the tea house. So we built out this ambassador affiliate program because a lot of people say, I want to share your teas. And I said, okay, great. So people can share our teas with their communities and, you know, get discounts for themselves and other people. And I just record a bunch of videos of some of the different brewing techniques and methods that we use, which are going to go up here pretty soon. And we send out the seasonal tea club. It just went out last week. And the seasonal tea club's cool because I take one of six, well, you know, Suzanne, I take one of the six principles of tea and I go deeper into it every season. So this most recent one that went out last week is in tradition. It's in the six principles under tradition, and the tradition I was focusing on was Zen. So I did a whole write up on different tenets of Zen and how they relate to different aspects of tea. Last season was about diet in the history of food. And the season before that was about virtue versus ethics or morality. Mm. You know, so we go into, I do a deep dive in a topic every season. And then it goes out with teas and why they're special and why they're seasonally appropriate and how to prepare them and all that. So it's kind of a fun way to get engaged. And then if you subscribe to our newsletter on the homepage, you'll hear about these upcoming tea ceremonies, which are going to be coming down the pipe here pretty soon.
I think that's beautiful.
And what address is it?
I have it on the screen. I've been actually putting it in the chat, and then we'll make sure all this is included on the radio broadcast. LivingTea.net.
LivingTea.net. LivingTea.net. That's easy. That's a good one.
Colin.
Don't go LivingTea.com because somebody will snag that probably.
I've been trying to get it from it's a guy in Hawaii who's had it for about 6 years. And every time I try to buy it from him, it's gone up another $2,000. And I go, come on, man.
LivingTea.net.
Well, it's okay.
Yeah. So it looks like we're sticking with .net for this lifetime. You know?
Yeah, it's all good.
That works. Well, listen, it's been beautiful. You can hang up on us. We're gonna talk about you and how good of a god you could be.
I so appreciate it. I love you, Colin. It's so good to see you. Yeah, I can't wait to come out there and see you in the mountain range.
Yeah, love you too, Suze. Let's talk offline here soon.
Okay. Ciao.
Ciao.
Okay, cool. Bye guys, take care.
Bye. Hey, there he is. All right. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got into it more. You guys talk about your teachers more than you actually speak your own words and your, in terms of your own experience of it. So you honor your teachers to such a high degree. And I think that's beautiful. But your own personal experiences relative to a sutra or a Zen koan is really where you start to see, you know, where the person is in their understanding and their belief.
Right.
It's cool to see him do that, like to start to go beyond the teacher. And, you know, he is the teacher.
Of course.
Right? He is the teacher.
A wise man that's worn robes in many lifetimes.
Yeah. No, he's cool.
He's definitely a Dharma brother and just a, you know, anyone that can connect to his works. I posted some of the teachings here, or teachings, the writings, they are teachings. And things people can dive into. It's really, you know, so accessible for everyone. And tea is a great way, especially if people are feeling lonely right now. A bowl of tea will give you that inner hug. It's pretty magical. And it does deepen your relationship with nature. So
you're taking that conscious time out for yourself and at least being there with yourself in time and space, possibly if you're doing a tea ceremony by yourself. But More of a how to go about doing the dishes, how to go about cleaning up the house, how to go about fixing your car, how to get through your day. It's how you are in the mundane tasks of life that make it extraordinary. A lot of times people live from event to event. You know, they have to feel like they got to go to the best concert, or they got to go to Hawaii every other week, or they got to go to this place in order to feel validated. But it's really how they are on the way to their events that allow them to really appreciate that event. And so a lot of, for me, in what you do with the tea, it's more about just reminding yourself how to be, literally how to be. Like, how should I be in these set of circumstances in order to become better? And to do what he said as God, and that is to quest and to figure out how to realize your potential in this time and space between action and cut, which is the time that we arrive to the time that we leave.
It's happening now.
Yeah. There's definitely a major transition happening. And that's good for everybody to shake it up and to break form and to come back with fresh perspectives that actually serve everybody on a grander scale can only be better. We can only get better by doing that.
Absolutely.
As long as, you know, your captors have good intent and you know, understand that you, as a human being, you are divine, and that there is a high sense of intelligence within each one of us. And if you're trying to hold us as captors, fool us into thinking that we're something other than that, that it won't work very long. So you know, everybody that takes the time to be has all the answers at their fingertips.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting, it's a great quest. And Wonderful. So who do we have next?
Well, we'll have a little pause. So anyone that's listening, I think we have a couple of listeners and we got some comments there too, is Autumn Sky. She's an artist up off the Sunshine Coast in British
Columbia.
And it's very beautiful pairing today to have Colin and her. She's an otherworldly artist also. So like some of the ones we had, beautifully masterful. So as inspired, for those that have tuned in, come back here on Indie Creators in the Joy Zone Facebook Live. You can watch that segment with Autumn Sky. In addition, we'll be running this segment on Spotify, on iTunes, on Amazon Music, Google Play, Pandora, iHeartRadio, the World Wide Web, and many other streaming services. So you can just look us up under Indie Creators in the Joy Zone and jump into a little bit of the Joy Zone.
All right, good. Well, so we'll be back soon.
All right, signing out.
You are listening to Indie Creators in the Joy Zone with your host, Thomas Artavani and Suzanne Toro. We are streaming worldwide on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google Play, and Amazon Music. Let's jump into the Joy Zone.
So follow the sun, the direction of